This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, it's Latte from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Just recently, Adam Gopnik published an essay in the New Yorker about Adolf Hitler's rise to power in the early 30s. By way of reviewing a book about the ascent of German fascism, Adam discussed the ways that Hitler exploited the weaknesses of a democratic system to gain power as a fascist. He wrote about the enablers in the German press and in the German military. And while I was reading Adam's essay, all I could really think about was our present predicament, the return of Donald Trump in the 2024 elections. Now, Adam never mentions once Donald Trump in his essay. And yet, the subtext is blaring out its warning at full volume. It would be foolish to say, and Gopnik does not say, that Trump equals Hitler, that Nazism equals MAGA. And yet, as the saying goes, history may not repeat itself, but it rhymes. Since losing the 2020 election and refusing the peaceful transfer of power, Trump has put the rule of law itself on his enemies list. He thunders about terminating articles of the Constitution. He holds up a mob of insurrectionists as political martyrs and hostages. He says he'll round up his enemies, whom he dehumanizes as vermin. And he's joked about being a dictator, if only just for one day. So, how seriously should we take this? And what historical comparison is legitimate? Adam Gopnik came by the office recently to discuss it all with us. A couple of years ago, you laid claim legitimately to having been among the first people to call Trump a fascist, which yes. Many people were quite wary to do. What were you seeing in 2015, 2016 that allowed you to use the word fascist where Trump is concerned?
Well, you know, my favorite essay on fascism is Umberto Eco's famous essay on the subject. Eco, of course, grew up under Mussolini and had an intense firsthand experience of it. And the point he makes is that the mistake we make is searching for a fascist ideology, that the essence, if you like, the core of fascism is not to have an ideology because it makes you dependent on the charismatic leader. And the charismatic leader may twist right one day, mm-hmm. twist left the other day. One day he's in favor of government control over capitalism. The next day he's in favor of free enterprise. So that the allegiance to the fascist leader is purely charismatic. You have no idea where you're going. It changes. But you follow it exactly because you're caught up, so to speak, in a tractor beam in a sci-fi movie, in the inexorable pull of the charismatic leader. I should add, right, that there's a scholarly and historical debate about Hitler exactly about did he have a plan and an ideology, which he then executed, however hideously, or was he a kind of paranoid improviser? My own reading, and several years ago, as you may recall, David, I did a whole piece about Mein Kampf. I actually sat down and read Mein Kampf when it was republished in Germany for the first time. And what's startling is that it isn't an ideological testament. It's an account of wounds and humiliations that Hitler had suffered. Not being allowed into art school is a huge one for him. And his hatreds of the French and the Jews and the rest of it come out of the sense that these people have perpetually humiliated him. It's a creepy, strange, non-ideological document in that way. What it does, of course, is it gives license to people who share his sense of resentment and humiliation to articulate and express those things.
But it would require, on the part of the fascist leader, the would-be fascist leader, an element of mastery and connection with a public. Otherwise, it's just a book written in the dark of night and completely meaningless. How would you connect those two figures, if you would, meaning Hitler and Trump, which seems like an outrageous thing to do, but is it so outrageous?
Well, I think that there are genuine and powerful similarities between authoritarian right-wing nationalist authoritarian rulers. Left-wing totalitarian rulers are another and related phenomenon and issue. And in certainly in that sense, the idea that you would have someone, and this is, you know, disputed within the Hitler literature, but I think strongly, whose power lies in his shamelessness. Throughout Rybak's book and throughout the literature, people are constantly trying to persuade Hitler to stand, you know, he was a soldier, you know, be there for the fatherland, make compromises that you need to make. Because they imagined that Hitler had a core set of positive values that were as strong as his hatreds. And in that sense, Trump is a very, very similar psychological type. The positive doctrines of Trumpism are very hard to enunciate, right? And even when they fail, we'll build the wall. Then you don't build the wall, but it doesn't disable his appeal. The negative doctrines of Trumpism, who you hate and who you now have a right to hate, the libs, the immigrants, the Muslims, are very well defined. Those are the key emotional offers. So in that sense, I think that we're not wrong to see a very real similarity, recognizing, of course, all the differences and circumstances that surround them.
How would you compare the publics involved, the Weimar German public and the American public and its circumstances in 2016 and again in 2024?
Well, one of the points that the many of the political scientists and historians who studied the Weimar elections make is that the 32 elections, there were several, were normal, which was startling to me when I first encountered that.
Normal in what sense?
Well, exactly. Normal in what sense? And what they mean by it is that it wasn't that the whole of Germany or the great majority of Germans were suddenly lit aflame by a nihilistic appetite for apocalyptic transformation. They were voting along lines that they normally did, very much as in 2016 and 2020, and I fear in 2024. People voting for Trump are not voting for the end of American democracy, for burning it all down, beginning again. They're voting according to longstanding patterns. Republicans vote Republican, no matter who the Republican candidate might be. And they're voting to protect what they perceive as their interest from their enemies. Now, often those enemies are largely imaginary, as the Jews were an imaginary enemy in Germany, a tiny, tiny, I think 3% of the population, tiny minority. And in the same way, it's quite clear that the Marxist socialists who are now tearing our country apart, and when you identify them with people like Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, as these Marxist socialists, you're clearly not—
Fascist and socialist.
Yes, they're simultaneously fascist and socialist. And it's clear that in that vocabulary, it's completely empty, right? It's a form of name-calling, but it creates obviously a kind of hysteria.
Mein Kampf was a collection, as you point out, of resentments, hatreds, autobiography. What are the collections of Trump's own autobiographical resentments and incidents that might have caused him to go from being a shady real estate guy in New York and seemingly a self-knowing New York character? How did he make the leap from that to this entirely other thing?
I can think of a couple of things that play along. One is that his sense of social humiliation on the part of the New York real estate establishment especially. I once wrote a long piece about the five families of New York real estate, not the five mafia families. And they had contempt for Trump, and he felt that contempt. He was an outsider. He was never allowed into the mainstream of New York social life where museums and philanthropies and public libraries and so on, which often favor very conservative figures like David Koch. But nonetheless, he was not part of that world, and I think he felt the exclusion. But I was present and wrote about, it's the only time I've ever been to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the famous one in which Obama mocked Trump at the height of the birth certificate madness. And by the way, David, it is typical, I think, of rising authoritarian leaders that the fire hose of crazy is so intense that we forget significant things. Trump came to political attention by telling an insane lie about Obama's Americanness. Obama, to his credit, welcomed Trump into the White House the day after his election or that week. And there you saw, I just by chance, the New Yorker table, where I was not far from the Trump table. You know, normally Americans are trained to be good sports,
right? Three seats away from you.
Yeah, yes, exactly. You know, you're good sports, you, when somebody mocks you at a roast, you shake your head and you...
You know the camera's looking at
yes.
you and you laugh a little bit.
Right, and you poke your companion and you say, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Stood there, stock still, his neck fixated, intolerable humiliation to be treated that way.
Donald Trump is here tonight. No one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter. Like, did we fake the moon landing? What really happened in Roswell? And where are Biggie and Tupac?
There are people who believe that that was one of the things that drove him forward to declare his candidacy. You know, I wouldn't be resolute on that point. But I certainly think that, and this is a genuine analogy, that the accumulated humiliations of a lifetime, the feeling of never having been deferred to, respected in the Godfather-like sense sufficiently, mm-hmm. are very, very powerful actors.
I'm talking with Adam Gopnik, a staff writer at The New Yorker, and we'll continue in a moment. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm David Remnick. I've been speaking on the show today with Adam Gopnik. Recently, Adam wrote an essay about the rise of Adolf Hitler. He was reviewing a book by the historian Timothy Rybak, and in the course of that essay, he focuses on the dilemmas faced by Germans a century ago. Germans who knew that Hitler was exploiting democracy in order to obliterate it and replace it with the form of fascism known as Nazism. And the question is, what relevance is that dark episode to our own politics of 2024? Donald Trump was elected in 2016, and the difference between the German experience and the American experience, if we're going to make these comparisons, is that, in fact, between 2016 and 2020, yes, Trump said a lot of miserable things and enacted some policies that were equally miserable, but that there were, in fact, people in his administration and in the bureaucracy and in the national security establishment who were in fact, to use that Washington establishment phrase, guardrails against something far, far, far worse and more unhinged. That did not maintain in Germany.
No.
So what are the differences there, and what are we now looking at as the campaign proceeds?
Well, nobody can predict the future, but it certainly seems overwhelmingly clear, to me at least, that 2024 Trump is more embittered and enraged than ever, more incoherent and deranged than ever, and possessed now of a firm belief that he can uproot the deep state. He shouldn't trust those generals who he trusted in his first term, all of whom were, as we know, utterly appalled by his character and behavior. But
Mattis, Milley, those people.
Exactly. Kelly, right? And were very reluctant in ways that are sort of predictable. Military men do not like to be in opposition, open opposition to the hierarchy. It's not how they're trained. And even now, and I think it's a source of some alarm, those people, Mattis, Milley, Kelly, who have been explicit in their contempt for Trump and in their fear of Trump, are very reluctant to take a leading role. They see that as not appropriate for them. They refuse to do it. I think it's one of the more frightening aspects of what's going on. But you just have to listen to what Trump is saying and believe what he says.
Why do you use words like vermin and poisoning of the blood? The press, as you know, immediately reacts to that by saying, well, that's the kind of language that Hitler and Mussolini used.
Well, that's what they say. I didn't know that, but that's what they say. Because our country is being poisoned. Look, we have, and we can be nice about it. We can talk about, oh, I want to be politically correct. But we have people coming in from prisons and jails, long-term murderers.
The demagogue always has a huge rhetorical advantage on the moderate and the rational speaker.
How would you compare the demagogic talents of somebody like Hitler or Mussolini to Donald Trump?
Well, Hitler is a fascinating case because, of course, one of the things that's most striking about him is that he did not incarnate in his own person the imaginary ideal that he was putting forward all the time. You know, it's a famous story that Charlie Chaplin, the first time Charlie Chaplin saw Hitler in a newsreel, said, oh, he's imitating me, right? Because he had stolen the little pencil mustache. And then Chaplin, of course, brilliantly imitated Hitler. He was an old-fashioned orator in the sense that he was, you know, grandiloquently rhetorical with hand gestures and so on. It's a newsreel and a meeting hall style rather than a television style. And Trump clearly has a television style. I've always thought that Trump's tone derives from insult comedians, you know, from the Sam Kinison type, right? That as much as it does from earlier American demagogues. That's part of its quiddity, and it's one of the things that makes it powerful. It feeds on American familiarity, that kind of insult comedian, and the understanding, right, that they both mean it and they don't mean it.
That's really interesting. You're watching him, and depending on who you are, you're either outraged or you're amused. Or if you're outraged, some people will think, well, he doesn't really mean it.
Yes.
How does he pull that off? And why is it so important to his popularity and his sustained stature in our political life?
Because his function is to give license. It gives permission to people to express and articulate hatreds and resentments that in normal social life they would be reluctant to do. But he also gives them the insurance, the immunity of being able to say, oh, he always exaggerates, mean tweets. It's curious, and I want to push these analogies to the proper edge and not past it. But Hitler's general tone was always hugely sarcastic. People tend to forget that. You know, when even well into the war, his tone was mocking and warning. And I think that that ability to simultaneously give his followers license for their very worst impulses while also giving them a kind of alibi that enables you to feel, oh, well, I'm not really inscribed in that. He goes too far, right? That's the classic protective thing we say about the demagogue. He goes too far, but he's right about a lot of things. Right now, I'm sure you have heard that, David, as I have, for many, particularly, I'm bound to say, for many very wealthy people. Oh, he's a clown. He goes too far. But he's not wrong about A, B, and C, right? He's not wrong about immigration. He's not wrong about the woke, right?
Cultural politics.
About cultural politics, right?
You quote in your essay, no less an authority on fascism than Goebbels, the propaganda minister of the Nazi Party. And Goebbels said this, the big joke on democracy is that it gives its mortal enemies the tool to its own destruction. The tools to its own destruction. As you look at the various attempts to stop Trump by constitutional means and watching them fail very often, are we falling somehow into the same trap? I don't want to have the analogy stretch so thin, but are we falling into the same trap as the Germans in the Weimar Republic?
To a considerable degree, I think that we are. And I think the trap, though, is more complicated than we sometimes recognize. Liz Cheney is quite right to say that we're sleepwalking into dictatorship. That's a risk. But I think just as well we might say we are role-playing our way into dictatorship. We see it so clearly with the attempts to use the instruments of law, of the judiciary, to come to terms with Trump. And it seems at one level, it seems self-evident that you should do this. I've written in the past, you know, if Abraham Lincoln had been inaugurated on January 20th, Trump would have been in prison on January 21st because the one thing Lincoln would not tolerate was sedition. That was the whole point of Lincoln's administration.
Well, wait, what should have been done?
I think that we should have had the courage, Merrick Garland, whomever is in the position Garland is the, to not try to placate or not try to accept the fact that there was going to be a confrontation with Trump and Trumpism after the properly so-called insurrection.
In other words, to have the courage of your convictions and the letter of the law.
Yes, exactly. And instead, I have the strong feeling that Merrick Garland, the people around him, for the most honorable of purposes, said, let's not do that. Let's follow the procedures of the Department of Justice more than the letter of the law. You know, liberals are, by training, proceduralists and institutionalists. Let's protect the institution. Let's follow the procedures. And that will be the powerful antidote to the demagogue.
So as a liberal, you think liberalism is fatally flawed in this sense?
I think liberalism is perpetually ailing in this sense. Let me put it a little more. Yes, as somebody who is an evangelist for liberalism, one of the perpetual traps for liberalism is you get too invested in your own procedural integrity, and you congratulate yourself for your own procedural integrity, and you entirely miss the scale of the threat. And in a confrontation between institutionalists and fascists, the fascists always win.
What's the scale of the threat here, of the election of 2024?
I think it's enormous. It seems to me that Trump could not be more categorical in his plans. We know from the people around him, this very motley crew of embittered and resentful authoritarians, that they have a plan too. Let's uproot the so-called deep state, which is simply a synonym for the rule of law. Let's use the Department of Justice clearly, explicitly, and without apology to go after our political opponents. And of course, what then gets said is, oh, but the Biden administration is doing the same thing. And of course, they're not. But it's very difficult to readily construct in a persuasive way the profound differences between what's been going on the past 4 years in terms of bringing Trump to justice and what Trump is proposing and what Trump actually did. People now forget the Durham report, which was done entirely at Trump's behest so that somebody would officially go after his political enemies, even though it turned out to be a complete circus, a complete clown show.
Well, let's be self-examining here. Are institutions like The New Yorker, The New York Times, the so-called liberal mainstream media in all their shades and varieties, themselves being too complacent, behaving in a way that is not appropriate to the occasion? There's a lot of internal debate and discussion about that. Let's make it public. What's your view of it?
I think so, yes. You know, Ryback, in the book I'm writing about, has, you know, deeply painful, mordant fun with the New York Times correspondent in Birchall in Berlin at that time, because he was constantly doing that. Well, you have to understand what's really going on here, right? Don't pay attention to the demagogue's rhetoric. You have to understand the maneuverings of the conservative political class. They're the ones with the real power.
Is that happening now?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think that it's not our instinct, and we're implicated in this along with the Times and the Post and whomever, is that we don't want to simply repeat ad nauseum an ideological message. We can't simply be ringing our bell, or I do, but ringing our bell and saying terror, terror, terror all the time. And as you know, David, one of the things that makes journalism journalism is having something new to say, right? If you're simply repeating Trump is dangerous and deranged, Trump is dangerous and deranged, it ceases to be interesting to your readers, to your editors, and those are their enormous internal—
Does it cease to be heard?
I suspect it ceases to be heard, too, but our job is, I think, to be right, to be right, and to tell the truth. You know, I lay no claims to particular prescience or of any kind. But in 2016, I was saying, this guy is not a clown and he's not a regular issue Republican. Call it what you want. Retro-fascism, neo-fascism, post-fascism. This is something totally outside the realm of normal American.
We don't disagree. Then, but what should we be doing if we're going to be a little intramural about it?
Speaking up, saying it over and over again, saying it loudly, going out to—
And we're not just speaking to the converted?
You know, the choir are the only people sometimes you have to preach to.
Right.
You know, what I always say about that, it's one of the things I worship about Albert Camus, who's maybe first among all my heroes, is that Camus was writing brilliantly and passionately about totalitarianism, about the occupation, in a newspaper called Combat, mm-hmm. that no one read because it was a clandestine newspaper. But his job was to teach the people on his side how to speak, what the right arguments were, what the wrong arguments were, to help find a tone and a manner, a voice, if you like. That's what we're doing, is to find a voice that can speak against the encroaching danger.
Adam, let me read a passage to you. This is you writing about the 1932 German election and the measures that Hitler's opponents contemplated to stop him. A war in the streets, or more likely a civil confrontation leading to a military coup, seemed horrific. The trouble, unknowable to the people of the time, is that since what did happen under Hitler is the worst thing that has ever happened, any alternative would have been less horrific. What's the analogy with 2024 if we imagine that Donald Trump, who is now leading in the polls, comes to office again?
I don't know, David. Like you, we have children who are growing up in this world, and the last thing in the world we want for them is to have live through an era of civil violence or much less civil war or revolution. We want, to the degree that we can, to maintain those guardrails and those institutions. They seem to me to be coming under a stress that may not be endurable. What we can't do is kid ourselves about the scale of the threat, or delude ourselves about the nature of the threat. I am not a prophet, and I don't think it's useful for writers to pretend to be prophets. I don't know what the outcome is. I know that it will be, it's already been terrible. You know, I wrote back in 2016 that countries don't recover from giving way to authoritarian demagogues like Trump. And, of course, in one level, everyone said, well, we did. We got him elected out and all that. But clearly we didn't, right? The virus is still raging and it's still—
Well, but that leads me to this question. 4 years ago, before the last election, Politico wrote a piece with the following headline. Trump is an authoritarian. So are millions of Americans. And that leads to maybe even an even darker conclusion. Are Americans committed to democracy as much as we believe them to be?
I don't think, David, I think the answer is that Americans, not uniquely, but human beings generally, are less committed to democracy than we want them to be in entirety. Liberalism, liberal democracy, has always been, despite the accident that you and I might have grown up in a time when it seemed to be a bulwark and successful, liberal democracy has always been a desperately beleaguered and endangered set of beliefs.
And fragile.
Fragile beyond measure. Perpetually fragile. In my own lifetime, I can remember in the 1950s when I was a very small child, the sense that, world communism is militant and strong and will eradicate liberalism. Ronald Reagan, people now no longer remember, came to power not saying America is inherently strong, but that we're desperately weak in the face of Soviet expansionism and so on. After 9/11, how many times did we hear, right, that we can't resist the decadent, ironic liberal societies of the West, can't resist kind of Islamic fanaticism and certitude. So liberalism is always being seen as beleaguered and dying. And in a sense, it always is because it's hugely fragile. And it's a set of conjoined attitudes and beliefs and practices that are often hard to define and are rarely neatly, narrowly inspiring. So I am threatened, feel frightened about all that. On the other hand, the truth is that in each time, liberal democracy, liberal practices have been threatened. They have emerged, often at the end of terrible struggles, triumphant and intact because they offer the possibility of living in prosperous and pluralist societies of a kind that no human society has offered to the same degree, something we should be proud of, where an amazing number of faith practices and personal practices and sexual practices and political practices can all coexist. That's a unique human phenomenon, and it's one that we should protect with the last breath of our bodies.
Adam Gopnik, thank you very much.
Pleasure being here, David.
You can read Adam Gopnik's essay on the rise of Adolf Hitler at NewYorker.com. We discuss Timothy Ryback's new book called Takeover, about the 1932 elections in Germany. Adam Gopnik's newest book, All That Happiness Is, comes out in April. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
For so many Black people, The Wiz feels like home. Like home. The new stage revival has Broadway buzzing. And as it gears up for a national tour, we'll consider the impact this story continues to have 50 years down the yellow brick road. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on the next Notes from America as we pay tribute to The Wiz. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Science fiction has historically been considered something of a niche genre with exciting scenarios playing out on far-flung planets. But these days, science fiction seems to be shedding light on a future that's maybe already here. On The New Yorker's podcast, Critics at Large, our staff writers talk about the new Dune movie and Netflix's Three-Body Problem. And they also consider older works like The Matrix, which gave us Red Pilling, and Contagion, which everybody seemed interested in watching yet again during the COVID pandemic. Science fiction as a form of realism. That's on this week's episode of our podcast, Critics at Large. The novelist Percival Everett has been getting a lot of attention lately, including a profile in The New Yorker. His novel, Erasure, was made into the film American Fiction, which just won an Oscar for its screenplay. And he has a new novel out, his 24th. Staff writer Julian Lucas is fascinated by Percival Everett's work.
Whether it's his novel, I Am Not Sidney Poitier, about a character who ends up stuck in the plot of basically every Sidney Poitier movie, or Erasure, about a Black novelist so frustrated by the pigeonholing in the publishing industry that he writes an elaborate literary prank under a pseudonym. to read Percival Everett is always to grapple with the prejudices and the assumptions and the acts of imagination that we have to make in communicating with one another through fiction and through art. And so when I saw that he was rewriting Huckleberry Finn, I knew that it would be an opportunity not just to read a great narrative, but also to read along with him one of the foundational stories in the American narrative.
Everett's book is called James. Here's Julian Lucas talking with Percival Everett.
So I love how this novel begins. I mean, first of all, the title, because in Twain, we know this character as Jim, or, you know, sometimes as more derogatory epithets, but immediately he's announced as James. And the reframing you do is just so clear in the very first sentence. And I wonder if you could read for us the first page of the novel.
See if I can get closer. Those little bastards were hiding up. The moon was not quite full, but bright, and it was behind them, so I could see them as plain as day, though it was deep night. Lightning bugs flashed against the black canvas. I waited at Miss Watson's kitchen door, rocked a loose step board with my foot, knew she was going to tell me to fix it tomorrow. I was waiting there for her to give me a pan of cornbread that she had made with Sadie's recipe. Waiting is a big part of a slave's life, waiting and waiting to wait some more. Waiting for demands, waiting for food, waiting for the ends of days, waiting for the just and deserved Christian reward at the end of it all. Those white boys, Huck and Tom, watched me. They were always playing some kind of pretending game, where I was either a villain or prey, but certainly their toy. They hopped about out there with the chiggers, mosquitoes, and other biting bugs, but never made any progress toward me. It always pays to give white folks what they want, so I stepped into the yard and called out into the night, "Who dat dare in dat dark like dat?"
What I love about this is you take a scene that in Twain is a kind of fun prank played by these two boys, and you immediately make us see it from the bitter, exhausted perspective of a grown man who has to play along with these children's games, essentially because he's a slave. And you hear it immediately in those little bastards. Mm-hmm. How did you arrive at this voice for Jim?
Well, I don't know. The first thing I did to start this was I read Huckleberry Finn 15 times in a row. And, you know, I would stop and just go right back to the beginning. Until it became a blur. How when you say a word over and over, it finally sounds like nonsense? Well, I needed it to become nonsense because I didn't want to merely regurgitate scenes. I needed to own the material, and that allowed me to own the material. So I was never saying what I thought Twain had said because I couldn't remember what Twain had said.
I love that. It's almost a river-like reading experience. You keep going back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I know you have a very high opinion from nonsense and of mm-hmm. nonsense and have written essays on it. Did you stop enjoying it after a while?
I was sick of
it. Did it affect your...
Yes, I was sick of it. I wanted to be sick of it.
How many readings did it take to get sick of it?
A couple. Once you've read something, you've read it. And I think after three or four, I was really tired of reading it, but I had to keep reading it.
Do you feel like it's a voice that you found in the book? I mean, you know, when Jim talks to Huck in The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, he's usually calling him Chile and Honey and all these sweet, affectionate mm-hmm. names. Was there a kernel of the character you created sort of hidden in Twain's character, or did you kind of have to invent him whole cloth?
You're right. He doesn't. He is not inclined to use the same kinds of terms of endearment that Jim uses in Huck Finn. But it's also because there's a my Jim is he's not simple. The Jim that's represented in Huck Finn is simple, and that's the part that Twain wasn't capable of writing. For Twain, a slave was a simple person. And by simple, I don't mean uncomplicated. I mean not terribly smart.
One of the themes you've been most interested in throughout your career is language miscommunication. You studied the philosophy of language as a graduate student, and so many of your novels are interested in these kinds of misunderstandings and failures of language. What interests you about the way slavery shaped communication?
I can preface that with a complaint about a film. And that's 12 Years a Slave. When this black man who has been living as best friends and neighbors and co-workers with white America is stolen away from his home and spirited down to a plantation in the South, he's thrown into a situation with slaves. And he can understand what they say. And that can't happen. He does not speak their language. People who are oppressed find a way to talk to each other that does not allow their oppressors to understand what they are saying. And he would be as lost as that slave owner would be listening to the slaves talk to each other. And I was offended by that film because it cheated the enslaved people out of their humanity. The other thing about it is just the humor. People survive with humor in the most dire of straits, and the picture of slavery that's painted in literature and film, the people are all just, how would you put it, bleak. Whereas if they're surviving, they're surviving because of their strength and their irony.
I'm glad you brought up humor because your work is really known for finding humor in unexpected places. Your novel, The Trees, is a very dark satire about the legacy of lynching in the U.S. And did you want this book to be funny? Did you want it to be funny in the way that Twain's work is funny?
Well, not funny in that way. And I think naturally I seek to employ humor as a disarming tool. I don't know how to be funny. If I try to write funny, I think I fail. The lesson I learned from Twain is that humor exists in the irony of the situation. I can't write jokes, but I can find the humor in the human condition.
In your story, James isn't just running to freedom. He's also reading and writing about it. And throughout the book, he hallucinates these very funny debates with philosophers like Voltaire and John Locke. And you put them in the middle of these really dramatic moments when he's been bitten by a rattlesnake and he's hallucinating, or he's trying to catch a fish with his bare hands. I wonder if you would read one of these moments for us from page 48.
I was in Judge Thasher's library, a place where I had spent many afternoons while he was out at work or hunting ducks. I could see books in front of me. I had read them secretly, but this time, in this fever dream, I was able to read without fear of being discovered. I had wondered every time I sneaked in there what white people would do to a slave who had learned how to read. What would they do to a slave who had taught the other slaves to read? What would they do to a slave who knew what a hypotenuse was, what irony meant, how retribution was spelled? I was burning up with fever, fading in and out of consciousness, focusing and refocusing on Huck's face. François-Marie Acquet de Voltaire put a fat stick into a fire. His delicate fingers held the wood for what seemed like too long a time. "I'm afraid there's no more wood," I said, "which is fine, because I am hot enough. Too hot."
To me, there's a kind of kismet in the fact that James, your appropriation of Twain, is coming out at the same time as American Fiction, Cord Jefferson's adaptation of your novel, Erasure. For our listeners, it's a
It stars Jeffrey Wright as a very literary black novelist who is so fed up with stereotyping in the publishing industry that he writes a street novel under a pseudonym as an elaborate literary prank. So you wrote it in 2001 at the height of the vogue for urban lit. Do you think the story still has the same resonance in our post-Black Lives Matter era when at least for a moment a lot more attention was given to African-American literature? I suppose it's a way of asking, do you think black writers are as confined now as then, or is there just a different kind of confinement?
Well, no, there's a much greater range of work available now. Some really fine writers who've found places in the literary world, and so things have gotten better. A few months ago, I stayed up late and I turned on the television at 3 a.m. and there was a Abbott and Costello movie. I don't remember the title of it. It was something like Screams in Africa, and in it were all of these stereotypic black Africans, wide-eyed and afraid of everything, running around carrying stuff for white people. And I realized, well, yeah, we have more, but we haven't gotten rid of this baggage. The producers or whatever you call the people, the programmers of this network, saw no problem with airing this. They had a slot, let's use this. And it's that kind of insidious insertion of the old stuff that caused so much damage to black psyches that persists.
You know, I was rereading Huck Finn for this, and it just struck me how wildly contemporary it still feels. You know, like Huck's abusive father sounds like a MAGA voter.
Oh, yes.
He's so angry that he saw a rich black man voting that he wants to overthrow the government. And I wonder if it was anything in what's going on in this country today that brought you back to the text and got you thinking about a story from Jim's perspective.
Well, I think that is true, and I think it was unconscious more than anything else. The U.S. really hasn't changed in character all that much, and what defines us remains the same. You know, the interesting thing about Huck Finn is it's the first novel that it's not that it's about slavery; it's about a man who was enslaved. You know, when you think of Stowe's novel or some of the slave narratives, they're about slavery. They're not about Americans, white Americans experiencing the shame and the contradictions of the condition of slavery. But here we have this young American, this youth, who's having to reconcile moving through the world as a free person while this person, the only father figure in the novel, is property.
Exactly. And Huck's flight from home, his own kind of search for adventure, is the emphasis in Twain. And yet there's a much higher stakes story going on for Jim, because this runaway, it's a matter of life and death for him,
yes,
even though it's more a matter of adventure and hijinks for Huck. So it's one thing to really love a writer as you love Twain, and it's another to actually try to rewrite their most famous book. And I wonder, was there like a particular moment in the book that you realized Jim had more to say than Twain lets him? Or was it more, you know, this would be a great way to sneak onto the high school English syllabi?
It was, you know, first of all, I have to say that this novel doesn't come out of a dissatisfaction with The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. I imagine myself in a conversation with Twain doing this. And one of the things I think that he and I would both agree on is that he doesn't write Jim's story because he's not capable of writing Jim's story any more than I'm capable of writing Huck's story. In fairness to the novel, it has flawed. It is flawed in that Twain stopped in the middle of it and then came back to it. And when he came back to it, I think there were some mercenary considerations at stake. And so it becomes more of an adventure. Tom Sawyer comes back into the novel, and the tone of the novel changes. It's less an exploration of Huck's confusion about Jim and his condition, and more of a pure adventure. And so I'm addressing that as well. I'm trying to get past that switch in tone that happens. But more importantly, I'm writing the novel that Twain could not. He was not equipped to do it.
Something I've always found so ironic about Huckleberry Finn is it's recurrently targeted by well-meaning anti-racists to either be redacted, to remove the N-word from it, or to cut it from syllabi entirely. And yet, there are few novels that have been more championed by the greatest African-American writers. It was so huge for Toni Morrison and Ralph Ellison, and Ishmael Reed recently wrote an essay, which is just a kind of rousing defense of the book and of Twain's insight. What do you make of this discrepancy in the way that it's been both condemned and celebrated?
Well, it's condemned by people who don't read the book, and have a reaction to, and actually, it's an excuse for them. It's you've got to be against something, I suppose, and apparently, the word scares people. Quite frankly, if someone came into my study right now and shouted at me, "You dirty N-word," I'd be just as offended as if they actually used that six-letter word that I just said. it's all about intention and meaning. It behooves fascists to ban it because there is a proper and direct and interrogation of what it's like to live in a world where slavery is present.
And where con men and hucksters are running rampant.
It's an American story. and that honest depiction is probably what scares some people.
Thank you so much.
Certainly.
The novelist Percival Everett. His new book is called James. Julian Lucas is a staff writer at The New Yorker. I'm David Remnick, and that's The New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Toon Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, and Louis Mitchell, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Mike Kutchman, Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deccan.
And we had additional help this week from Alicia Zuckerman and Jared Paul.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.